From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in a small southern town after all the bars had closed. The owner of a store in town, a white man, was angry that a young African-American man had insulted him. The white man, Lyle Britton, wanted an apology. And when the black man, Richard Henry, refused to apologize, Britton shot him to death, then left his body face down in the high weeds. Britton is convinced he had every right to kill the black man and that he could never be convicted of the crime in court. Well, this is a fictional story. It's the story at the heart of James Baldwin's 1964 play, Blues for Mr. Charlie. Baldwin wrote the play as a dedication to Medgar Evers, and he based it loosely on the real-life murder of Emmett Till. The story challenges the audience to examine what it means to consider all people as truly human, worthy of dignity, worthy of rights. It is at times searing, hard to watch, emotional. Baldwin thought it was a story that needed to be told. And this weekend, the MUC, the Multi-Use Cultural Community Center, is bringing Blues for Mr. Charlie to the stage in Rochester. Gary DeWitt Marshall directs this rendition, which stays true to Baldwin's script and mission. I had the chance to see the performance last night. You can see it this weekend, tonight at 7, Saturday at 7, Sunday at 2 p.m. Our guests this hour are here to discuss the themes and the performance of what has been, for decades now, a remarkable and vital piece of American theater. Gary DeWitt Marshall, director of Blues for Mr. Charlie, welcome back to the program. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Evan, and happy Valentine's Day.
I guess happy Valentine's Day to you, too. I say for those celebrating. There are still some curmudgeons out there. That's
right.
Okay. Almeda Whitus is here, an actor who plays Mother Henry. Almeda, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Evan.
Richard Kendrick is an actor who plays Parnell James, whom the New York Times described in 1964 as really the only good white person in town. Welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you very much.
So I will say, having now seen the performance at the Multi-Use Cultural Community Center, it's a powerhouse. It is emotional. It's tough, hard to hear and watch at times. Gary, I suppose that's what it's supposed to be, right?
Staying true to the integrity and intent of Baldwin's work, there's no way to distill it.
I'm going to quote from the New York Times review in 1964 about what the Times, how they described what this was about and how it came up, knowing, by the way, I'm reading some of the language of the time here from the New York Times, 1964. Quote, James Baldwin has written a play with fires of fury in its belly, tears of anguish in its eyes, and a roar of protest in its throat. Blues for Mr. Charlie throbs with fierce energy and passion. It is like a thunderous battle cry. It is a summons to arms in this generation's burning cause, the establishment in this country of the Negro's full manhood with all the perquisites of that simple yet lofty station. End quote. This generation's burning cause, full manhood. That was in 1964. Mm-hmm. How much of that review still feels like it's being worked out today, Gary?
Well, I think part of the ironic tragedy of this is its current relevance. As I say to the cast, if this was loosely based on Emmett Till's murder, this will be relevant tomorrow and 2 weeks from now. And unfortunately, it's become too much of the normal part of our daily lives.
And so for you to make the decision to put it back on stage and bring it here to Rochester, again, Gary, you've done a lot of work in theater. How did you come to the decision to do this particular piece and do it now?
Well, I've been a fan of Baldwin since college, and I've been involved with this project for a number of years. And I think I did a reading a couple years ago just to hear it out loud. It's a play that's lengthy, and it deals with a lot of complex issues. But it's also a challenge to direct. It's a large cast. There's a lot of flashbacks and continuity things. So it's not an easy thing to do. When I approached it this time, I started with interpreters of the text that I could trust. People who would embody these roles fully, knowing that they might be diametrically opposed to who they are. And I will say, you know, during the audition and pre-audition process that several people couldn't do it. They just weren't able to bring themselves to do this. And I appreciate that.
Too emotional, too hard?
Too emotional, too hard. Some people admitted that this was, you know, too close to home, that this was echoes of what they heard in their home, and they were didn't want to be reminded of that. So it's tough. It's a tough play in every aspect. I think what's interesting is it's as hard performing it as it is receiving it in the audience.
I imagine so. And listeners, again, you got a chance to see it tonight, 7 p.m.,
mm-hmm.
Saturday, 7 p.m.,
mm-hmm.
Sunday, 2 p.m.
Yes.
And Writers and Books, a proud co-sponsor of the production that's taking place at the Multi-Use Cultural Community Center that's just off University on Atlantic, easy to find. And so three opportunities this weekend to see it. We'll talk coming up here about what it is like for the performers. I mean, because it's got to be draining for everybody, as you say, and we'll get to that. But why don't you tell the listeners who are not familiar with Blues for Mr. Charlie, kind of set just kind of the scene for I mean, without giving too much away, what the play focuses on.
Well, I think the first thing that the audience will see is nothing. I mean, it's presented in a style that I call enhanced minimalism. So there's a blank, stark stage, save for some blocks, which are utilized by the actors. And they have their scripts in hand. So presentationally, it's like a staged reading, except more. Stylistically, I chose this presentational device to have Baldwin's work be most prominent. That they're nothing, as I say to the cast, without pretense or uniform, to just present these words in an authentic, earnest way, and the rest will take care of itself. So I think that the audience will be, well, you can't help but be taken, brought into it, because there's a tragic scene in the beginning, the very beginning of the play,
yeah,
that thrusts you into this world of 1955, or Ferguson, or Rochester, or Buffalo, Detroit, Albuquerque. I mean, you name it. It brings into relevance immediately after the first crackle of gunfire.
There is a sense throughout the play, one of the dramatic arcs is wondering if there will be justice for the audience, because, I mean, there is certainly, Almeida's already laughing at that. Probably, if I can interpret Almeida, laughing because it's a wistful, fruitless hope for justice when we so rarely see actual justice. Is that why you were laughing, the idea that there might be justice?
Well, that's part of it.
Okay.
What comes to mind immediately is no justice, no peace. Yeah. no peace, no justice. And I want to add another city, Charlottesville, is it Charlottesville?
Charlottesville, yeah. Virginia.
That is what happened in Charlottesville is pretty much what happened in our opening scene. A black man is just brutally killed from the back, and those protesters in Charlottesville were mowed down by a car from the back. So it's like the racism comes at you from every side. However, it comes from the back when you when you're not expecting it. And as an audience member, you're sitting there thinking, "Oh, I'm going to just sit here and enjoy this," and then you get hit in the back, just like Richard does at the opening.
Yeah, and so the audience is immediately, from the crackle of gunfire, I will say, it's hardly even a crackle. I mean, it's thunderous. and it shakes you. I mean, it gripped, being there last night, it gripped me and the people who were in that room, and basically it put you on sort of a tension's edge that didn't really dissipate for the entire show.
Exactly.
But yes, I'm going to say, I will just say naively, you're going to find yourself rooting for a conviction, for justice, for the man, Lyle Britton, who owns the store. He is what the New York Times Review called just sort of a poorer Southern redneck who has a number of friends in town. They're white. He is friends with Parnell, who is, we'll talk about Parnell's character in just a moment here, but Lyle's not remorseful for having killed a black man, and you find out that his history runs even deeper than that, that he's not remorseful for previous events. His sort of naive wife Jo, seems nervous that maybe he actually did commit this. She seems mildly conflicted, like doesn't want to believe that her husband would have committed this, but still willing to maybe lie for him, still willing to maybe say that it was deserved. And I guess what happens is you watch this knowing it's set in the 50s and it came out in 1964, but you find yourself still wanting justice.
I'd like to sort of disagree with you about her being mildly conflicted.
Okay.
I believe she's very conflicted.
Very conflicted, very conflicted.
Wondering, by saving herself for marriage like a good white Southern woman,
yeah,
when she finally gets married, probably at the end of being able to have a baby, mm-hmm, and she's wondering, was it worth it? If she's going to have to live the rest of her life till death do you part with a murderer. That to me is almost every woman's, no matter what your race, every woman's deepest, darkest fear, to have the monster in her man come out. And he's totally justified. History justifies him. And as an audience member, if you're expecting No. This is what has happened historically, mm-hmm, from the very beginning in this country. There is no justice unless you're privileged. And Baldwin's use of privilege underneath this whole thing, we're looking at the people in the black church, the people that are marching. They are pretty much, in my mind, almost privileged because they're, I don't see them like in the black town. They're not sharecroppers. They are workers, church people who consider themselves good, upstanding citizens. And they're working and protesting for the right to vote. I don't even think it has anything to do with jobs. I think this was about voting, the voting rights, mm-hmm, in the mid-60s. I mean, I was there. Not there down south, but I was up here doing my share of protesting at the age of 15. And the white town, it's like, this is the way it's always been. We have to make sure that everything stays in place. And Parnell's character reminds me of a young man that I worked with in Dallas. And he talked about coming from a family of redneck, right? Racists. And his grandfather, his great-grandfather, his father were all upper echelon Klan. Mm. And he was the only person in his family to think otherwise, like a Parnell. And he was ostracized. And he ostracized himself. He went away. And when we were talking about it in the workshop, there was a young black woman, because this young man just broke down and cried, said, I've separated from my family because of their racist beliefs. And then the young black woman said, at least you have a family. You've got history of knowing who your grandfather, your great-grandfather was. She said, I only go back as far as my father. I don't know anybody else in my family. So there's loss and there's this longing for home and family that I believe is like sort of a cradle for this piece. Now, I may be crazy, but I make my living as a storyteller. So I make this story work in my head for Mother Henry to become who she is, and she's changed from the very beginning. I can talk about that later. I'm kind of hogging the mic here.
No, you're not. Not at all. That's why we're here, Almeda. Almeda Whitus plays Mother Henry, who, by the way, why don't you just tell the audience then, because we've talked about the fact that at the center of this play, a white man murders a young black man, who, by the way, Richard's character is how old in I'm trying to...
25, 26,
yeah,
maybe.
He's come back from the North. He's a young African-American man, comes back to the southern town where he's from. But Mother Henry is who?
Yes, she is his grandmother. And she has pretty much raised him in the church. And her belief is that God takes care of his own. And because she believes in God, because her son Meridian, the minister of the church, believes in God, that they raised Richard up to be a good, strong, God-fearing man. Where did he go wrong? What did I do wrong? Did my son have anything to do with it? Oh, perhaps it happened with his mother, but there's nothing that could be done about that because that's just how it is. That's just how it is. Black women have to endure rape and murder, raising children who will be growing up to be raped and murdered, tortured. And that's just the way it is. We just have to believe in God.
And I want to ask all three of our guests about this idea of, as you say, your character, the grandmother in the play, raising a grandson within the church. But also the way that Baldwin uses the script to my ear, attack Christianity used as a weapon. Christianity, the guise of Christianity, sort of the faux Christianity. Here's what the Times said about that. I'll read what the New York Times said about that, and I'll start with Almeda. I'd like all of our guests to kind of weigh in on this. Quote, James Baldwin uses his play as a vehicle to address his issues with Christianity, a religion historically used to justify the enslavement of Africans. He argues that Christianity is a type of plague that has, quote, the power to destroy every human relationship. Through the character Lorenzo, he denounces it for its ability to be used to preach passivity while endorsing violence. Lorenzo articulates the lack of empathy that Christianity has for the black community, calling it the white God, who ignores others' suffering at the hands of the irrational. He accuses the reverend of praying to a God that only cares for those who are white and asserts that it is the God who is responsible for the destruction of black lives.
Mm-hmm.
What do you make of that, Almeda?
Well, let me put it this way. That's deep. That's really deep, and it goes into me personally. I remember as a child, I was about 4 years old, and I was attending Sunday school at what we call a storefront church. It's just like a storefront, and there's a church in there. And this one particular Sunday, the Sunday school teacher wasn't there for the two classes, and the preacher took over. And he's standing there with kids ranging from age of 4 to 12, and he's preaching about sin. And if you tell a lie, if you do anything against your parents, you're going to go to hell. And you're going to go to a place where there's a devil, and he has horns, and he's red, and he has a tail and a pitchfork. And he's going to stick you with that pitchfork and throw you in a lake of fire, and you're going to burn forever and ever. He says, do you understand me, children? And I raised my hand. He said, yes, little girl. I said, well, excuse me. Are you saying that if I do anything bad, even if I tell my mother a lie, that means when I die, I'm going to go to hell and meet the devil with horns, and he's red with a tail and a pitchfork, and he's going to stick me with that pitchfork and throw me into a lake of fire where I'm going to burn forever and ever? That man's face lit up. He looked like spirit was coming through his face. He said, oh, yeah, now see, that little girl, she got it. And I just sat back and I said, I don't believe it. Inside, I said, my God wouldn't do that. I never believed that. I heard the truth in my heart, and it wasn't coming out of that preacher in that storefront black church at the time. So Mother Henry, I believe, inside, she knows the truth. And this truth is opposite of the lie that the black church has been perpetrating, kowtowing to this whole Christian belief that we're right. And you have to believe in our white God with his white hair and his robe and his flowing locks, beard. And, you know, he's powerful. He's all powerful. And he's white. And that's who God is. And I'm like, no. Mother Henry is like, by the time she confronts Richard, and she starts getting into the young people that are out there marching and fighting for justice and for truth, she becomes militant herself, her own type of militancy. And it isn't strident until she's in that courtroom. And she never really addresses the speaker, whatever he is in the court. She's talking to God, she's talking to herself, and she's affirming the value of her grandson and that his life meant something, and it oughtn't be forgotten.
The courtroom scene is remarkable in its own right. Gary, what do you make of what the New York Times said about the critique of Christianity in this?
I think that it's right in line with Baldwin's history, who was a child preacher. And I think that he felt the discriminatory, contradictory things of the church that left him skeptical. And I don't think that he could reconcile or separate the inconsistencies in race or Jim Crow or any of those things that prevailed in society. I don't know that he could differentiate those things or justify them through Christianity. So he was very skeptical. Lorenzo is, in this case, probably more outspoken about his disdain for the church. Mm-hmm. Meridian, who is the preacher, finds himself conflicted as well. So, Baldwin doesn't. He leaves you with more questions than than answers, and I think that that's a really good for introspection. I think what you should be left with is, where do I stand at the end of the day? I mean, it's what Parnell is certainly faced with, and you know, maybe you'll get into it, but I think that Parnell can, for most non-whites, answer or at least extract the question of what does it mean to be an ally?
Isn't that interesting? I mean, because that's a term that's much more in use today than it would have been in 64. Mm-hmm. But the question of Parnell James, played by Richard Kendrick, who's with us, is sort of what side's he on? I mean, I think he's asked that question directly in the courtroom scene. Parnell James is described by the New York Times as the only good white in town. And Richard, why don't you describe your character in Blues for Mr. Charlie?
Well, I would say he's good to an extent. I think that it good in this context is a relative term. I think he thinks he's a good man, despite the fact that at the beginning of the play, in his first scene, he says he's not, but I think he believes he is. I think he believes he's doing the best he can in the circumstances in which he finds himself. I think he learns that that is not good enough, that his attempt to straddle the line between the two worlds, and in the play as it's set up, those two worlds are described as Blacktown and Whitetown, and he's tries to shuttle between and placate both, but understands, I think, by the end of the play why that's not satisfactory.
He has a relationship that goes back many years with Lyle, the man accused going to trial for murder. I mean, the man who committed the murder.
Right.
And he has reason to believe, even before he hears it directly, that Lyle committed this murder. He also has a relationship with Meridian,
mm-hmm.
Richard, the murder victim's father, that goes back years. As he describes it at the trial, it's a different kind of relationship
right.
between the two men. But do you think that he viewed those relationships as both genuine?
I think he thought they were genuine.
Yeah.
And I think that he hoped against hope that Lyle was not guilty of the crime that he strongly suspected that he might have committed. He tries to convince Meridian to keep an open mind about it. Meridian, of course, is more skeptical. But I think he's trying to protect himself from the reality that he has to eventually face.
I think the interesting point about Parnell that Richard describes as well, who a character who has to reckon at the end with maybe knowing he didn't do enough, the audience finds itself, at least from my perspective, starting to put a lot of emphasis on the power that Parnell had to maybe make some change here, because there's a scene in which a lot of the white people in town are meeting with Lyle and his wife, and the white people are all telling him, "You got nothing to worry about, Lyle. You know, you'd never be convicted. Nothing could ever happen to you. You're not going to go to prison. I can't even believe they're arresting you. Do not worry about this. This is a white town. You are a white man. You're fine." And Parnell shows up, having worked all night, kind of all disheveled, but still sharp enough to tell them, "Well, of course he should go to trial, and of course he should get a real trial, and of course, by the way, yes, there should be black people on the jury," to which the white people are going, "Well, why would that be allowed?" And Parnell's going, wouldn't we think that's fair? Shouldn't we have? And he's sort of speaking truth to the other white people in town, and you're getting this momentum, this sense that Parnell's going to be the one to stand up, even in a trial, and say, "I do believe he did it." And that puts a lot of this emphasis that, without giving too much away, he's left with a lot to reckon with at the end. But it was your performance was very powerful.
Thank you.
And so let me ask both the actors at the table. I'll start with you, Richard. I mean, was it was this a more draining performance than most of what you're used to on stages?
It is a draining performance. I'm not going to say more than what I'm used to,
okay,
because this is not my first
sure
portrayal of this type of character. And any time you're portraying this type of character, it is draining. I think Lyle may not be quite as bad as some of the others I have portrayed, but he certainly...
You mean Parnell. You said Lyle.
I'm sorry, Parnell, yes.
I think Lyle would have been as bad.
Parnell would have been as bad, yes. I played Lyle-type characters
sure
as well. But yes, Parnell, I don't think is as bad as some of the characters I have played in the past, but he's certainly bad enough, and it's a very intense role to do.
How do you feel, Almeida, at the end of this performance? I mean, do you feel drained?
No.
You don't?
No. I feel... can't really call it exhilarated. I feel... thank you. I feel like going on. I feel like going on. Though trials come on every hand, I feel like going on. And part of that feel like going on is referring to a term that you spoke maybe 10 minutes ago. Non-whites. How come we never hear non-blacks? It's about perspective. And Parnell, he's attempting to put himself in the role of a mediator and trying to get each side of the town to see the angels of their better nature, and becomes more and more disillusioned. And I'm not going to give away the ending because I was surprised at the ending. Yes, I knew of the play, but I had never read it. I'd never seen it.
I was surprised too.
Yeah. And what happens at the end is, I believe, a clarion call for America. And anyone who comes and experiences this play, who visits where these characters are, that and revisits the foundation of this country, they can't help but think there's going to be some kind of inner change. It may be to the better, and it may be that entrenched like that young white man who was in my workshop with his people. If his people were to see this play, they would cheer for White Town and say, yes, that's the way it's supposed to be. And there's going to be people that are going to not have their minds changed. It's just going to entrench them even further in the fear that feeds that racism. And I wish I could find a different word, because when you use the word racism, people just automatically shut down saying, that's not me. And it's like, yeah. Yeah, and it's internalized in terms of people my color, black people. It's internalized racism. And we all have to just lay down the bombs and bullets and embrace our forgotten brother named reason.
Do you want to add to that?
I was just going to add also that there's a lot of change that happens by the end of the story. And I think Parnell is changed by it, my character. Mother Henry described how she was changed by it. Meridian, I think, is certainly changed by it. And you had asked earlier about Baldwin's characterization of the Christian church. Mm-hmm. As being the church of perhaps suppression and passivity among the black community and the church of oppression among the white community. And I think that's fair to say that that's his characterization in the play. But I think as the play moves forward, you see changes in how people are going to, particularly in the black community, are going to accept that role of Christianity within their own domain. And I think that's an important thing for the audience to track as they're watching this.
You want to add?
Well, Richard's talking about change, which leaves me maybe a bit more optimistic at the end of the day. Parnell says to Meridian, you know, hey, man, it's not easy to surrender privilege, you know. And almost in the same breath, he says, listen, man, I know how this guy suffers. And it's almost, you know how Lyle Britton, this cruel, bigoted racist, suffers? And you got the audacity to say it to me?
I think the audience laughed, actually, at that
They
line.
Did. I was a little surprised by that.
Yes, when I remember that.
And especially that line that poor whites have suffered just as much as blacks suffered.
Everyone in the room, and Gary, that tells you the power of that moment when you're watching this. I think I will just say, at least from my perspective, you couldn't help but kind of laugh, as in like roll your eyes and throw your hands up and say, "Come on."
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But that's the power of that moment.
Well, and there are many of these moments, and they're subtly aggressive. You know, I mean, it almost hits you as an afterthought. But it's not belly chuckle funny. These are the things that you shake your head and if there is usually from the audience, they're not laughs, they're just audible gasps. Right, of exasperation, or it's the only thing that your body will do to vent what you just, you know. You know, so it's not like some audiences, you know, are listening audience. Some audiences are involved. I think there's a bit of a guilt, you know, to participate too much. Mm-hmm. But what Richard said leaves me thinking, because I think as things have evolved and we come into the words privilege, mm-hmm, or an ally, and what I got out of this is that maybe before, an ally or a friend, mm-hmm, was someone that was in proximity to your, mm-hmm, cause, maybe in the picture somewhere, you know, maybe photobombing. Right. But what's required more is an active participation in your allegiance. You got to do something. Mm-hmm. You got to show something. Mm-hmm. You got to have some skin in the game.
Yes.
Or else you're just in the picture frame.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. I have this inner picture of America as a body, a human body, that's been laying on the cooling board for 400 years. Hmm. And Baldwin is, what I want to say, conducting and sort of an autopsy, hmm, almost to bring some life into America. Hmm. Bring some life into America, bring some conscience into America, bringing true brotherhood, or today we would say personhood, to America. And America is just staunchly defending itself, mm-hmm, in the throes of the death that it is. Mm. It may be a little bit militant, but I'm known to be that way.
I mean, I'm transfixed. I'm glad to have Almeda Whitus here, an actor who plays Mother Henry, and alongside Richard Kendrick, an actor who plays Parnell James, and the director of Blues for Mr. Charlie, Gary DeWitt Marshall, who has brought Baldwin's award-winning and historic play, first debuted in 1964, to the stage in Rochester this weekend. Writers and Books and the Multi-Use Cultural Community Center, bringing it to the Muck this weekend. Friday, 7 o'clock. That's tonight, 7 o'clock. Tomorrow night, 7 o'clock. Sunday afternoon, 2 p.m. Three chances to see it. We are way late for our only break. And when we come back here, I'm going to ask the panelists, as we think about that sort of, as the Times described Baldwin's play as this rallying cry to the cause of a generation, has the cause of the generation, a generation or two later, has it changed at all? We're going to talk about that next. I'm Evan Dawson. Monday on The Next Connections, you'll hear a previously recorded conversation about the value or not of newspaper editorials endorsing political candidates. Then in our second hour, Ida B. Wells became a groundbreaking investigative reporter exposing the domestic terrorism practiced by white supremacists. This new Humankind special tells the true story of this fearless journalist. That's Monday on Connections. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. It is a powerful cast performance, and it's a big cast that you'll see on stage when you see Blues for Mr. Charlie. Gary DeWitt Marshall, I know you've worked with a lot of the people on stage. We can't shout out to everyone. I'll just say, really, the entire cast is outstanding. I do want to say the man who plays Richard just has you just wrenching, just wrenching performance. Is that Shaq?
That's Shaq.
I hope Shaq's listening. He's been on the program. There's a lot of talented people, so I want to be careful not to single out too much, but wow.
Well, I have a good eye.
Yes.
And I know Shaq from the spoken word circuit. And in my work, I've been able to convince some of the performing artists, spoken word artists, to try their hand at acting. And it's worked to great effect. Mm. The different skill sets, but I think that trusting me and understanding that I am an artist first and that I'm going to care for your art, respect your interpretation, and encourage you to fulfill your duty as an artist. So, you know, Shaq is stepping into it. And I asked him, I said yesterday, I called him Broadback. I said, hey, can you feel yourself growing?
Sure.
I said, because you're bigger than you was mm-hmm. when you started, mm-hmm. you know. And he said, I'm not there yet. I said, okay. But you're getting there. Mm. And anybody that I have the opportunity to work with, we grow together. You know, so I look forward to the opportunities. You can talk about that maybe.
Oh, okay.
Good. Yeah, Almeida, because Almeida, who plays Mother Henry, you've got some other work to
yes.
tell us about.
Yes,
tell us
indeed.
About it.
Yes, indeed. Thank you, Evan, and thank you, Gary, because this smudge stick experience, The Pungent Aroma of Truth, is his title. It is my life.
You got to say the title again, The Smudge Stick Experience.
Smudge Stick Experience, The Pungent Aroma of Truth, with an exclamation point. And it's the first of a trilogy, and it's something that I've been wanting to do pretty much all my life, to tell my story on stage as a one-woman show. And it's actually a two-woman show because that wonderful choreographer, dancer, Naima Nateri Atkins, she plays the inner Almeida, the spirit of Almeida, while I'm talking about myself. And last summer I met Gary for the first time and was lamenting over the fact that nobody knows who I am anymore. I no longer have any relevance. I just might as well just leave. And he's like, no, Queen Mother. No. You have a lot to give. People need to hear you again. And I will make sure that you get your chance. Less than, 2 days later, I guess he called and said, a spot had opened up for a piece for a 5-day run at Muck. And can you put something together, Queen Mother? I'm like, oh, yeah. So I just pulled, wrote the script. We rehearsed it twice. It went up 8 days later. And we took it to TANIS, Theater Association of New York State. It won Outstanding in every category and Best Show. It's the first play in the history of 60 years of TANIS to sweep Outstanding and Best Show. And so that meant that we will be taking it on the road to represent New York State at ESTA, Eastern States Theater Association in Wilmington, Delaware. Oh, it gets better. In the audience is, she's the former head, and she's on the board of the International Theater Festival. And she's like, we want you to come to Halifax, Nova Scotia. And this is Gary saying, don't worry, Queen Mother, I got you. And Spirit gave me the words. I put it on. And everybody seems to like it. So it's happening.
Well, it's happening next Monday the 17th. But the at Muck.
Monday the 17th at Muck.
Yep. 7:30.
7:30. But Evan, what's important, I think, about this piece, but maybe stylistically, is I'm the master of the blend. I am an ensemble. That's what I dig. So Smudge Stick is the convergence of a spirit, movement, motion, music, and it's really something that has to be experienced. She was ready made, fixed. I just provided the support around it, the theatrical elements that make theater to bring the magic out, you know. And she said that there's three characters. There's she, the dancer, musician.
Steve Imburgia, who was in one of my bands maybe 25 years ago. This is my first one-woman show in over 20 years.
And the soundscape and the visuals all coalesce to make a one-of-a-kind experience. And I'm thankful to Almeida for bringing her brilliance as a performer for many, many, many years and trusting me to just put forth my vision.
And it wasn't difficult. Because I'm used to directing and myself, and I totally told him, I will follow you. Whatever you say, I will follow.
It didn't quite work. I mean, that's not quite how it worked.
Yes, it did. From my perspective, it did. Okay, so I'm Lyle in this case. I see it my way.
Oh, man. Monday, 7:30 at the Muck, if you want to experience that. Smudge Stick.
Yes.
Amazing.
Thank you.
Amazing.
Can I say one thing?
Yeah.
In the talk back at our second performance, there was a white couple front and center, and the female was a teacher at Indian Landing School, and I'd done things there for years.
Sure.
And she's like, oh, Almeida, I haven't seen you in years, and we worked together 30 years ago, and this is wonderful. And then her husband said, excuse me, Almeida, I beg to differ with you. This is not a show. This is an experience, and every person in Rochester ought to see this play. So we changed the title to Smudge Stick Experience.
I like that.
Very smart. I thank that man.
Down to our last 3 minutes, so I'll give our guests, if they can try to keep it to about a minute apiece, and I'll start with you, Almeida. When we think about, she is taking a sip and sending it over to Richard. So Richard, you got to start. When we think about the themes of whether this current generation would have a different call to arms for finding equality in common humanity, or if anything much has changed since 64. How do you feel about that question?
I think the call to arms for this generation is around the concept of institutional racism and the connection between institutional and individual racism. I would say almost nobody believes they're an individual racist. In other words, I think most people think I treat everybody the same. It doesn't matter what color you are or anything else. Whether that's true or not is another matter, but that's, I think, what most people think. And they don't understand where institutional racism comes from if everybody's equal and acting equal. Mm-hmm. But yet it's there as its own entity with its own dynamic and its own systems of oppression that continue from generation to generation that have not been confronted. And I think that's the challenge for this generation, to confront that.
Gary, 1 minute. What do you think?
Well, I think that dovetailing on Richard's statement, just to keep it simple, Jim Crow exists. today. And if you need to identify him, maybe you don't look in a person. It's in systems. Mm-hmm. Jim Crow is live and present at 156 today. And it's, systemic.
Almeida.
Amen. Amen. Amen.
It's been wonderful having you here.
Thank you.
Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Almeida Whitus plays Mother Henry in this performance of Blues for Mr. Charlie. Richard Kendrick plays Parnell James. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
And again, I'll say to all of your colleagues on the cast who can't be at the table talking about this today, but I know you've represented the play very, very well, and they did a remarkable job.
Thank you, Gary.
Gary DeWitt Marshall is the director of Blues for Mr. Charlie. Tonight, 7 p.m. at the Muck on Atlantic. Tomorrow, 7 p.m. Sunday afternoon, 2 p.m. Have a great weekend with it.
Thank you very much.
Listeners, well, as we close the week here, just a reminder, when we say member-supported public radio, this is the last day of our winter membership campaign, and we hope that you are with us. We hope that you're a member. We know you're a listener, and we're thrilled about that. We're thrilled to have this wonderful community of thousands of listeners every day, and we don't take it for granted. We hope that you're a member, which means we'll be here for a long, long time. And if you can call 454-6300, you'll do it in less than 2 minutes, and you'll get right back to lunch or the afternoon or freezing your butts off or wherever you are. So whatever the case is, 2 minutes or less, 454-6300, WXXINews.org. Tim Shea, thanks for volunteering today. We'd love having you here. Emma Stein is the intern. Barsook Records provides the music. Rob Braden is the engineer. Megan Mack is the best producer anywhere. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a great weekend. Thanks for helping us toward our goal, and thanks for supporting member-supported public radio.